Today we're going to begin the book of Exodus. Someone asked me if we were going to spend 40 years with the book. I can't imagine why they would say that. The answer is no, because in 40 years I'm not going to be around here to finish. So the intent here is to not spend 40 years wandering around the book of Exodus. As you know, the book of Exodus begins in Egypt. Egypt is one of the most colorful and amazing cultures that has ever graced the planet Earth. The civilization in Egypt extended back over 3,000 years. Now, if you think about that from our perspective, that's 1.5 times the length of the Christian era. Think about that. During that 3,000 years, there were many kings who came to power. There were many kings who died, who passed from power. But generally speaking, over that period of time, Egypt was able to maintain an amazing amount of both political and religious stability. Now, there were times of chaos, without a doubt, and we'll talk about some of those as we go through this book. But generally speaking, Egypt is a pretty stable economy, a pretty stable culture for 3,000 years. What's amazing about Egypt are the time spans. They're really hard for us to fathom. If you live in a town like Dallas and you go to Boston, you get this feeling, wow, this is an old place. This is an old city. Then you go to visit the capitals of Western Europe, and you think, wow, Boston's not so old after all. This is really old. Then you go to the Middle East, and the Western European capitals suddenly don't look too old. But if you really want to see old, go to Egypt. Because Egypt is old. Old is everywhere in Egypt, everywhere you look. And it's really, really old. Let me try to give you just a little bit of perspective. We just studied the book of Genesis. Abraham lived about 4,000 years ago. When Abraham, Sarah, and Lot made their ill-fated trip down to Egypt, which is recorded in Genesis chapter 12, the step pyramid at Saqqara was already 500 years old. When Jacob and his family migrated to Egypt to escape the famine, Egyptian dynasties had ruled that land for over 1,000 years. And the pyramids at the Giza Plateau were 700 years old when Jacob got there. When Moses was growing up in the palace, the pyramids of Giza were 1,100 years old when Moses lived in Egypt. And there had been a history of dynastic rule in Egypt that extended back over 1,400 years. In 332 BC, Alexander the Great rested at the foot of the Great Pyramid on the Giza Plateau. And in 332 BC, when Alexander the Great stood there, the sun had risen on that great edifice over 820,000 times. That's hard to imagine. If you don't believe me, multiply 2,258 years times 365. You'll come up with a really big number. So for 3,000 years, this culture lived on the banks of the Nile River. And it was during that period of time that the story of the Exodus is going to take place. This is where it all begins, in the land of pyramids and dynasties and pharaohs. Well, when we study the book of Exodus, the question is going to come up. It comes up in my mind. Why would we want to study the book of Exodus? And why do you study the Old Testament at all? Isn't the story of Jesus contained in the New Testament? Isn't the story of the origin of the church a New Testament story? Isn't it there that we find the doctrines which as New Testament Christians were the most closely aligned? Well, the answer to this is certainly. But there's a lot of value in the Old Testament. And for me, the question is not so much should we study the Old Testament, but how should we study the Old Testament? It's a great deal of debate today in seminaries and in the books that are on bookshelves about how much Christology we are able to find in the Old Testament. Seminary students struggle with the question of this very issue. How much of Jesus can be seen in the Old Testament? Pastors read myriads of books in doing their sermon preparation. And the thing that's a bit disconcerting as you do this and you do your study, and you look and you see so-called experts who can't agree among themselves. And so it causes this question to arise within, certainly within me, and within anyone who studies these things, that the experts can't find consensus. How in the world can I be sure that the conclusions I draw are correct? Well, the fact is there always are going to be differing points of views, because the mind of God is deep, and we are fallen creatures working with flawed faculties. But it seems to me that if we look at the New Testament, we'll find there a standard for how we should view and read and understand the Old Testament, because the New Testament writers were not the least bit hesitant or shy about proclaiming Jesus from the pages of the old Hebrew scrolls. What I want to do today as an opening scripture, and I know you think we're never going to get to Exodus, I want to take just a minute and look at a couple of New Testament scriptures that I think bear on how we should study the book of Exodus. And the first one is in the 15th chapter of Romans, verse 4, where Paul writes, "For whatever was written in earlier times was written for our instruction, so that through perseverance and encouragement of the scriptures we might find and have hope." The Old Testament, certainly the book of Exodus, was written to the nation of Israel. That was the contemporary audience for the New Testament. But though for the Old Testament, but though the Old Testament was written to Israel, it was written both for Israel and for us as Christians in the church age. And there are benefits to studying the Old Testament that go beyond just the interesting stories that are there, the historical information that we can find. And we find that in the Old Testament, according to Paul, there is instructive information which cause us to persevere in the faith and to be encouraged in the faith, so that we have hope in the promises of God, whether those promises are Old Testament promises or New Testament promises. Let's look at one more chapter or one more passage quickly. 1 Corinthians chapter 10. What I wanted you to notice, the reason I chose this chapter, is I want you to look at the number of references in this New Testament chapter to Old Testament events, and particularly to events that occur in the book of Exodus. 1 Corinthians chapter 10, beginning with verse 1. "For I do not want you to be unaware, brothers, that our fathers were all under the cloud and all passed through the sea." In the Old Testament, when the Jews are brought out of Egypt, you're going to see that during the day there's a cloud that represents the presence of God in the midst of the people who have been brought out of Egypt. So he says here that our fathers were all under this cloud, they were in the presence of God, and all passed through the sea. All were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea, and all ate the same spiritual food. Obvious reference to Exodus 16 and the manna. Verse 4, "And they all drank the same spiritual drink, for they were drinking from a spiritual rock which followed them, and that rock was Christ." That's an obvious reference to Exodus chapter 17 and the rock of Horeb, where Moses was able to bring forth water for the children of Israel. Verse 5, "Nevertheless, with most of them, God was not well pleased, for they were laid low in the wilderness." That's a reference to Numbers chapter 14. "Now these things happened," listen to this, "as examples for us, so that we would not crave evil things as they also craved." Verse 7, "Do not be idolaters, as some of them were, as it's written, the people sat down to eat and drink and stood up to play." That is Exodus 32. "Nor let us act immorally, as some of them did, where 23,000 fell in one day," a reference to Numbers chapter 25. "Nor let us try the Lord, as some of them did, and were destroyed by the serpents," Numbers 21. These are all references back to New Testament events. Then we're exhorted in chapter 13, or chapter 10, verse 10, "Do not grumble, as some of them did, and were destroyed by the destroyer." Then once again, verse 11, "Now these things happened to them as an example." And they were written for our instruction, upon whom the ends of the ages have come. So these verses give us an important approach to interpreting the Old Testament. Namely, that as New Testament believers, we should interpret the Old Testament from the point of view that Christ is the final word in the story of redemption. That's what the words, "and that rock was Christ," means. I don't know how else to interpret that. The passage tells us that the experiences of the Jews in the Old Testament act as examples to us living in New Testament times. When we see this word "example," it's used a couple of times in this 1 Corinthian passage. It's the word "tupos" or "tupoi" in the plural. It's translated "examples," and it's the word from where we get the term "typology." What this means is that these Old Testament events are pointing forward to something. They're pointing forward. We're given here the opportunity to learn both from the victories and from the failures of the nation of Israel. Here we're forewarned not to crave evil things as they did. Do not be idolaters as some of them were. Do not act immorally as they did. Do not test the Lord as some did. And do not grumble. So my approach to Exodus is going to be exactly the same as the approach we took with Genesis, and that is that we will look for the historical context, we'll look at the original meaning to the audience to which Exodus was written, but it'll be our New Testament orientation that'll guide our interpretation. Let's start with something simple this morning. Let's talk about the name of the book of Exodus, the title. If you look at the Hebrew Old Testament, you'll find that the title of the book of Exodus is not Exodus. Exodus is a word that comes to us from the Greek translation of the Old Testament known as the Septuagint. If you look at a Hebrew Bible, you'll find that the title of the book of Exodus is Ve'eleh Shemot. These are the names. These are the names. So the opening words of verse 1 of chapter 1 of Exodus are the title of the book. And this is not something that should surprise us. If you remember back when we started the book of Genesis, the title of Genesis is not Genesis. It's Bereshit, which means "in the beginning." You see, it was common in the Hebrew Bible for the titles of their books to be the first word or the first few words of the opening phrase of the book. This is true with Genesis and Exodus. It's true with Leviticus. It's true with Deuteronomy, which is four of the first five books of Moses. The book of Numbers doesn't start with the first words, but the title for Numbers comes from the first sentence. But it's a word that's in the middle of that sentence. So this particular book, the book of Exodus, begins with the words, "and these are the names." If you have your Bible, I know this will shock you, turn to Exodus chapter 1. We will begin. "These are the names of the sons of Israel who came to Egypt with Jacob. They came each one with his household: Reuben, Simeon, Levi and Judah, Issachar, Zebulun and Benjamin, Dan and Naphtali, Gad and Asher. All the persons who came from the loins of Jacob were 70 in number, but Joseph was already in Egypt. And Joseph died, and all of his brothers and all of that generation. But the sons of Israel were fruitful, and they increased greatly, and they multiplied, and they became exceedingly mighty, so that the land was filled with them. Now a new king arose over Egypt who did not know Joseph. He said to the people, 'Behold, the people of the sons of Israel are more mightier than we. Come, let us deal wisely with them, or else they will multiply, and in the event of a war, they may join themselves to those who hate us and fight against us and depart from the land.' So they appointed taskmasters over them to afflict them with hard labor. And they built for Pharaoh the storage cities of Pithom and Ramses. But the more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied, and the more they spread out, so that they were in dread of the sons of Israel." The Hebrew text literally says they were loath to look at the faces of the sons of Israel. Verse 13. The Egyptians compelled the sons of Israel to labor rigorously. They made their lives bitter with hard labor in mortar and bricks, and at all kinds of labor in the fields, all their labors which they rigorously imposed on them. Then the king of Egypt spoke to the Hebrew midwives, one of them who was Shiphrah, and the other was named Puah. This is a little bit interesting. When you first read this, you think, gee, were there only two midwives for all of these Hebrew people? You may remember that Hebrew has the singular number, the dual number, which means two, and plural. A plural in Hebrew is three or more, which is an interesting difference in Hebrew and English. The word midwives here is not written in the dual. It's written in the plural. These just happen to be two of the midwives who are mentioned. But it doesn't mean there were just two. Verse 16. And he said, when you are helping the Hebrew women to give birth and see them upon the birth stool. That's an interesting word that is written in the dual. It's evanayim, which literally means two stones. Now, I have no idea what this thing looked like or how it worked. But that is the name of the birth stool. It's two stones. When you see them on the two stones, if it's a son, then you shall put him to death. But if it's a daughter, then she shall live. But the midwives feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt had commanded them, but let the boys live. So the king of Egypt called for the midwives, and he said to them, why have you done this thing and let the boys live? The midwives said to Pharaoh, because the Hebrew women are not like Egyptian women. They're vigorous, and they give birth before the midwife can get to them. Must have caused great anxiety for Hebrew husbands, I'm sure. verse 20. So God was good to the midwives, and the people multiplied and became very mighty. And it came about because the midwives feared God that he established households for them. Then Pharaoh commanded all his people, saying, every son who is born to you, you're to cast into the Nile, and every daughter you're to keep alive. The opening verses of Exodus provide this little short genealogy of the relatives of Jacob who came with him from Canaan to Egypt. And they're names that should sound really familiar to us because these are the names of the sons of Jacob, and we've just been studying about these men. There's something odd about the way the book of Exodus begins. It begins with the word and. It looks like this. That's the first word of the book of Exodus. I remember back in the 1960s, there was a comedian by the name of Professor Irwin Corey. He graced the television screens from such highbrow television programs as The Phil Silver Show, and of course my favorite, The Smothers Brothers. To give him his due, he also starred in one episode of The Phil Silver Show. Now, if that doesn't cause some neurons to fire, I don't know what will. Some of you have no idea what I'm talking about, and the rest of you who do probably don't want to admit that you used to watch those shows, but I know better than that. I don't know if you remember Professor Irwin Corey. He was as far from a professor as you could possibly get, and he always began his act the same way. And you know a comedian is a good comedian if they can do the same thing over and over and you still laugh. But he would walk out to a single microphone stand in the middle of the stage. He was just disheveled. He looked like he hadn't combed his hair in weeks. He wore a wrinkled suit. He looked like he was only half sure he was at the right place, and even if he were at the right place, wasn't sure why he was there. Then it would become very obvious just before he began his lecture that he didn't have his notes with him. And he would start feeling around in his pockets, and quite an uncomfortable period of time would go by, and he would finally pull a stack of 3x5 cards out of his pocket. But they weren't in the right order. So he would begin sorting and flipping, and finally he would look up with a confident smile, and he would begin his lecture with the word, therefore. Does anyone remember this guy but me? Who remembers? I got to know. A few of the gray hairs here recognize. Yeah. He was pretty funny. The reason it was funny is that words like therefore or and or now typically don't begin lectures, and they certainly don't typically begin books. Words like and are words that connect two thoughts or two ideas or two word groups together, like Adam and Eve or Andy and Julie. To make Exodus a little smoother for English readers, most of the translators begin the book with the word now. But the Hebrew word is and. Forces us to ask a question when we first begin reading the book of Exodus, and it's this question. To what does the book of Exodus connect? What does this word and connect to for the book of Exodus? Well, the answer is, it connects Exodus to Genesis. And you're thinking, why did he go through all of that? Irwin Corey. I should have written that up there, but it would have given away the joke. In Genesis, God chose a people for himself, which he built from the family of Abraham, and he brought them down into Egypt, and there he took a few, and he grew them into a nation of many. That nation is in Egypt at the beginning of the book of Exodus. So you have to understand, Israel is in Egypt for a reason. They're not there by accident. They're there by the foreordination of God as part of his plan. Now, there's more evidence for this than just that one little word at the beginning of the book. If you look at the first six Hebrew words of the book of Exodus, chapter 1, the first six words, I think they translate to about 10 English words, you'll find that they are an exact repetition of Genesis 46:8. So it's as though they took the first six words of Genesis 46:8, I'm sure he didn't copy, paste, click, brought them right over, and that's how the book of Genesis begins. The words are the same, but the contexts are different. The context of Genesis 46 is the imminent move of Israel from Canaan down into Egypt. Joseph has revealed his identity to his brothers. The brothers have come back to their father, Jacob, in Canaan, and they've revealed this information to him. The family has packed their bags, and they are on their way to Egypt. And then the genealogy is given again in Genesis chapter 46. The context of Exodus 1 is different. It looks, instead of looking at the imminent move to Egypt, it looks back from an Egyptian perspective over a long period of time, either 200 years or 400 years approximately, depending on how you interpret Exodus 12:40. We'll be talking about that at some point. And so in looking back from an Egyptian perspective, it automatically links us again to the book of Genesis. We see another support for that link in verse 7. Verse 7 is the verse that reads, "But the sons of Israel were fruitful and increased greatly and multiplied and became exceedingly great so that the land was filled with them." That's creation language. Whenever you see creation language, you're getting linked back to stories in the book of Genesis. In Genesis chapter 1, verse 22, God commands the creatures that he's created to be fruitful and multiply. Then he creates man, and in verse 28, he commands man to be fruitful and multiply. And this is such a significant story, such a significant idea in the Old Testament, that theologians have come to refer to that as the cultural mandate. The cultural mandate is God's command to his creatures to multiply and fill the earth. In the Hebrew text, it's even a little more graphic because the word sharatz is used there, which means that in Egypt, Israel grew, and they grew to be many, and they swarmed. That's what sharatz means. Sharatz is also a creation word. It's used in the creation account of Genesis in verse 21, and it's used of human reproduction after the flood in Genesis 8, chapter 17. So it's definitely associated with this idea of multiplying into a great nation. So we have this definitive use in Exodus of creation language, which brings our minds immediately back to the book of Genesis. And though this is not really our topic, I think it also supports the idea of a common authorship between the two books. Well, as our story is going to develop over the next few weeks in Exodus, we're going to find that God takes the forces of nature, which he created in Genesis, and he's going to use those in the section on the plagues to, again, tie us back to the book of Genesis. In Genesis, he creates these forces. In Exodus, he's going to use them to bring about his will with regard to Egypt and the king of Egypt. And he's going to punish the king of Egypt for the hardness of his heart and his unwillingness to obey the command of God that was given to him through Moses. When we come to verses 6 and 7, these are verses that mark the passage of time. Joseph was probably between 50 and 60 years old when his father died. And then we're told in verse 6 that he also died, that is, Joseph died at age 110. So at least 50 or 60 years has passed between verses 5 and 6. But between the death of Joseph in verse 6 and verse 7, where we read about this miraculous growth of the nation of Israel, quite a bit of time has gone by, and it's going to be in the neighborhood of 200 to 400 years, depending again on how we look at Genesis chapter 12, verse 40. And we're not going to get into that today. You can read it to your heart's content, and when we get there, Brad's going to, if he didn't lose this section, is going to tell us what his Amharic text type says about Genesis 12 or Exodus 12, 40. We've already had a conversation. But a lot of time has gone by between 6 and 7. Come to verse 8. That's really the verse that forms a turning point in what's happening here. It's a turning point for Israel, and it sets the stage for the rest of the book of Exodus. And that's the verse that reads, "Now a new king arose over Egypt who did not know Joseph." This likely does not mean that this king was ignorant of his nation's history. It does not necessarily mean that he didn't know the great service that Joseph had brought to the nation in saving them from the famine. But it does mean that if he did know these things, from his perspective, they were no longer important. Joseph is dead. His descendants have become a formidable force in the nation of Egypt. And it's a force with which the king does not want to have to contend if a war breaks out. So he sets in motion what we might call three executive orders that are going to change the relationship of the Israelites to the Egyptians forever, and they're going to set the stage for this great display of divine power at the Exodus, which will define the nation of Israel forever. So some immediate questions come up. Who's the king? How much time elapsed between Joseph's death and this order from the king to bring oppression on his descendants? Well, we're not told. If you know me at all, you know, yes, I'm tempted to chase rabbits and try to figure out all those answers. But there's another interesting question that you can ask, and it's this. How important is it to know these things if the Bible doesn't seem fit to give us the information about which we're curious? The Bible speaks authoritatively, but it does not always speak exhaustively. It doesn't always answer every question we'd like to know. So with regard to the name of the king, I want to try to shift your thinking a little bit and suggest that it is less important to know his name than it is to know what he did. What he does is he opposes the cultural mandate. His concern has to do with the population growth of the nation of Israel. If you notice his words in verses 9 and 10, essentially he says the population of these Israelites is becoming greater and mightier than we. He actually says they're greater than we are. That's not to be taken literally. His point is they're growing. They're becoming a formidable force. And if they continue to multiply at this rate and war breaks out, they may join up with the enemies of Egypt, fight against us on their behalf. But I want you to notice that, yes, there's a tangible military threat that the king is concerned about here, but there's also a theological conflict. It's God's will that man multiply and fill the earth, and it's certainly God's will, under the cultural mandate and under the Abrahamic covenant, that Israel reproduce and grow. Now, no matter what we do when we get over to Exodus 12 with the dates, whether they are in Egypt for 215 years or 430 years, it doesn't matter. The growth of Israel in Egypt was a supernatural phenomenon. And you may say, well, how can that be? Well, I can't answer all those questions, but it very well may be that God affected the birth rate. It could be that he affected the survival rate of his people. But the end result of it, whatever the method is that Israel grows in a supernatural way in the womb of Egypt into a great nation that is a concern to the king of Egypt. So we know that it's God's revealed will that the nation of Israel grow into a great nation. And so what we see here in this miraculous growth of the people is we see God fulfilling parts of the Abrahamic covenant. He promised Abraham that his descendants would grow into a great nation. And we see that that's happening here. Now, there's a tendency throughout history when we look at Egypt and Israel and Assyria and Babylon and some of these other places to see this as Israel versus the Arabs or Israel versus Egypt. But though that might be true at a tactical level, it misses a really significant point. The opening chapters of Exodus are not just about Egypt versus Israel. The king is not just opposing the Jews. The king's opposing God. When the king opposes the revealed will of God, especially when Israel is concerned, the king becomes a symbol of the power behind the throne, a power behind the throne that opposes God himself. And to take this a step further, these events are examples of God dealing decisively with that power behind the throne. God's already told the serpent, or Satan through the serpent in Genesis 3, that he will put enmity between the seed of the woman and the seed of the serpent. So when we see this king of Egypt opposing the will of God, we see that he symbolizes this satanic opponent. So this is the theology that's happening behind the scenes here. And we see clearly that God is acting on behalf of his elect people. And those people are in conflict with the king of Egypt, who symbolizes an anti-God power in play here. So understanding the king's role, what he's doing as he opposes God's program, is a lot more important than understanding what his name is. So I want to take a minute and look at the three executive orders that he puts forth. Let's take just a moment and do this. As I said, the issue for the king is the supernatural growth of the population of the Jews. And the first thing the king does is he lays out for the people what the perceived threat is. He says the Israelites are reproducing at an alarming rate. They're becoming a potential military threat. Now, there were some interesting things happening in this part of the world at this time. And some of you haven't been here, so just let this kind of go in one ear and out the other. But I mentioned earlier in our study of Genesis that I have been influenced quite a bit by a book written by David Roll. And because what he does in that book is he questions the traditional Egyptian chronology that I think is weak at best. And so if we work with Roll's new chronology, we're dealing here with events that occur in the 13th dynasty of Egypt. Joseph would have come down during and served the last two kings of the 12th dynasty and into the early period of the 13th dynasty. So we're probably still dealing here with 13th dynasty Egypt. And what was happening at this time in Egypt is that the power of the central Egyptian government was weakening. Egypt was about to fall into one of those three periods historically of political chaos. The concern was, at this time in the 13th dynasty, there was a very significant potential threat brewing on the horizon for Egypt, and that threat was a brewing in Asia. There were a group of Semitic peoples who by the 14th dynasty and certainly during the 15th dynasty were going to actually come into the nation of Israel, and they were going to push the native Egyptian kings south back into what is known as Upper Egypt, so that you have the native Egyptian dynasties trying to operate but doing so poorly in Thebes. And then you have this group of Semitic peoples who came in, and particularly during the 15th dynasty. They're known as the Hyksos. I should have written that up here. H-Y-K-S-O-S. They were Semitic peoples. They ruled in a place called Avaris, which is in the land of Goshen area here. And it's very possible that this concern that the king had about the Jews is tied to the fact that he sees his major primary threat to the political stability of Egypt being a Semitic group that may make an influx into his nation. And what would make more sense than for Israel to align themselves with their Semitic cousins and become yet again a more formidable force against the king? So this is what I think is behind this threat. The king knows that the central government is becoming weak. He knows that he has threats that are coming down from Asia. And they don't come down immediately, but his concern is absolutely true, because the Hyksos did come down, and they created a huge political problem and a military problem and a cultural problem for Egypt that lasted through the entire 15th dynasty. And it wasn't until one of the Egyptians, Akhmos I, Pharaoh Akhmos I, was able to push the Hyksos back out of Egypt. But he saw this threat coming, and he saw a very good fit between the Jews and the Hyksos. Now, it's going to turn out that the Exodus occurs before the Hyksos come in, but he didn't know that. So I think that's what his big concern was. I've got a problem here with Semitic peoples, and I've got about a million of them living in the land of Goshen that could rise up and pose a problem. Look what we did in World War II with the internment camps. We were afraid because we were fighting the Japanese, right or wrong, that there could be internal problems caused by, and it's a sad thing, it's a sad moment in American history. But look what we did to American citizens who were of Japanese origin during World War II. We put them in internment camps. The concern was the same. The people who made that decision, and in retrospect, obviously we wish they hadn't made that decision, but they made the decision based on what sounded like a logical problem that might occur. And that is, if we're invaded on the Pacific, on the West Coast, we may have this problem. That's how he saw it. And you're right. He could have been a little more diplomatic and created an alliance there, but I think he feared that the blood is thicker than water scenario, and that when these Hyksos came in, he was afraid that the Semitic peoples living here up in the northwest part of Egypt would side with them and make that influx of peoples even worse to handle.
He's also got the problems, a lot of their own making, because they chose not to assimilate the Hebrews into Egyptian culture.
We talked about this. This is the reason behind God taking the family of Jacob out of Canaan and bringing them to Egypt, is they were assimilating into the Canaanite culture. The Canaanites weren't becoming like the covenant family. The covenant family was becoming like the Canaanites. So God creates this famine. He takes them down into Egypt, which was probably the best place on earth to be a poster child for non-assimilation. And the Jews end up here in this delta area. And if you'll remember, we studied this. The Egyptians loathe shepherds. And so they did not allow them to assimilate. So whatever this period of time is that's gone by, we have this separate people. And the idea of alignment is one thing, but the idea of having them actually assimilate is just not Egyptian. Egyptians don't do that. We're going to see this when the Jews come out of Egypt and they're in Sinai. They have a confrontation with the Amalekites, right? There's a battle. That was one of the first waves of what you might call early Hyksos, as they began, the Amalekites began to make their way toward Egypt.
Amalekites are the Hyksos.
No, they're a part of that Semitic group that eventually took control of northern Egypt. They're not the... I guess you could say that Hyksos is a broader term than Amalekite. But that's what's happening to the king here. He sees this threat, he sees the Jews, and he says, we got to do something. So he issues an executive order. The first way he chooses to deal with this problem is by changing the status of Israel from foreign residents to slaves. Slavery debilitates people. And he thought he could control the Jews by making them slaves. According to verse 11, the Jews were conscripted to build two cities for Pharaoh, the cities of Pithom and the city of Ramses. And they set taskmasters over the Jews. Now, back in Genesis 47, we read about something called the region of Ramses. Do you remember that? When there's an editorial note there that says that Joseph settled his family in the region of Ramses. It's in verse 11 of chapter 47 of Genesis. Here we see the city of Ramses. And this name Ramses has posed a great deal of controversy in Old Testament interpretation. The presumption is that the region and the city are named after the 19th dynasty king, Ramses II.
Why?
That's just the presumption. That's one of the four major pillars of Egyptian chronology that Roel takes apart. But if you look at a critical commentary on the date of the Exodus, on the authorship of these books, you'll see that they will go to the name of this city, and they will argue backwards from the name of the city to try to establish the date. And since we have the 13th dynasty historically, Ramses is a 19th dynasty new kingdom pharaoh. There's at least 600 years discrepancy here in these dates. But I'll tell you what I think the answer is. I think it's a simple anachronism. Let me give you an example.
Let's get a couple hundred years off.
Yeah. Let me give you an example of what I'm talking about. I have my grandmother's birth certificate. My grandmother was born on January 12th, 1905, in a place called Indian Territory. Now, you know I'm from Oklahoma, don't you? She was born in Indian Territory. There's a good chance if you walked up to me on the street and said, Rocky, where was your grandmother born? I might say she was born in Indian Territory, but more likely I would probably say she was born in Oklahoma. But the great state of Oklahoma didn't become a state until November 16th, 1907, which is 2.5 years after my grandmother was born. So let me ask you a question. If a teenager walks up to me and says, Rocky, where was your grandmother born? And I say, Oklahoma, am I wrong? See, the purpose of language is to communicate, and communication doesn't always require absolute precision, depending on what's being communicated. Now, we know that the Jews lived in this area called Goshen. We know from archaeology that there was a city there named Avaris, A-V-A-R-I-S. We also know that a city named Pi Ramses, P-I is the Egyptian word for house, House of Ramses. So we'll call it the City of Ramses. We know that the City of Ramses was built on top of Avaris. So the Bible's correct in saying that the location of this first Israelite settlement and the work that they did under conscription was building the City of Ramses. Because it's writing this, the Bible is being written to an audience of people who probably would not have known where Avaris was, but would be very familiar with the city that was built on top of that site. So this may very well be just an anachronism here in the text, and I don't know whether it was originally put in or whether it was put in some time later so that people would have an orientation here that they would understand. But I think that's all that's happening here. Nevertheless, Pharaoh puts them under servitude, and his plan doesn't work. Because verse 12 tells us that the more he oppressed them, the more babies they had, the more the population grew. So he issues executive order number 2 in verses 15 and 16, and he orders these midwives to kill the males but to spare the females at the time of their birth. And again, the purpose here is to control population growth of the Hebrew people. But the king misses a really important point, and that is that these Hebrew midwives were faithful to Yahweh, and they disobeyed the king in order to obey their God. There was not yet a series of laws written on stones. That's going to come later. But there was an innate sense of right and wrong written on the hearts of these women. They were faithful. And they obeyed God by doing what they knew was right and by avoiding what they knew was wrong. Something ironic here, too. In their refusal to obey Pharaoh, surely at the risk of their lives, the very thing with which God blesses them is the very thing Pharaoh is trying to keep from happening. It says that he established for them households. To carry the theme of irony just a bit further, the content of the blessing is exactly that. The more Pharaoh oppresses the people, the more they grow. The more he orders the midwives to kill the boys, the more boys are born. So the chapter ends with verse 22, which is really the third executive order. When all else fails, he escalates his plan and tells the people to kill the Hebrew male children outright. And I suspect this was a method of killing that was quite common at the time. They were to be thrown into the Nile River and left to drown. Think about this. We've talked about this. The Nile River was the source of life for the Egyptians. Pharaoh decrees that it become the instrument of death for the Hebrews. But don't miss this. Pharaoh decrees water to be a source of destruction, a destruction of God's people. But God decrees water to be a means of deliverance for his people when he divides the sea. After delivering Israel through the waters, God then brings down those waters on the heads of the Egyptian army. And the thing that the Pharaoh had decreed would be the end of the Hebrews becomes the instrument of judgment of God on the Egyptians. God is presented in Exodus 1 as the one who is in control of the circumstances surrounding his people and the circumstances surrounding those who would oppress them. Joseph was very clear about God's hand in what's happening here. He said, "It was God who sent me to Egypt, albeit through the evil agency of his brothers." In the next chapter, God is presented as a compassionate God who's aware of the plight of his people. We read this and we understand that Egypt is not an exception. There's going to be oppression of God's people from other nations, from Babylon, from Assyria, from other peoples. But through it all, God is the Lord of history, and he's fully in control of the history and events that affect his people. In the New Testament, God's lordship over history is presented in the person of Jesus Christ. We know from Paul's words to the Colossians that by Jesus all things were created, things in the heavens and things in the earth, the visible, the invisible things. He's over thrones, he's over powers, he's over rulers, and he's over authorities. Sometimes it may seem that God is absent from current events. Surely if God were in control, then this or that wouldn't happen. We face a difficult time in our country. The airwaves are not at all absent of people claiming to have the magic bullet to solve all of our problems. I'll remind you that that will be the campaign platform for the Antichrist when he comes. He will claim to have an answer for every problem. In times like this, it's easy to begin thinking that our future depends on whether we elect the right Pharaoh. It doesn't. We should be wise, but our future is in the hands of our sovereign God. And it's no less so today than it was for the nation of Israel in this difficult time in the nation of Egypt. Let's not forget where our hope lies, because it's the same hope that we're going to see work out for the favor of God's elect in the book of Exodus. So that finishes chapter 1.